This podcast of Bookworm is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very delighted to have as my guest Umberto Eco. It's the first time that he has been on the show, and a long-awaited opportunity for me. He is the author of 5 novels, of course, The Name of the Rose, Foucault's Pendulum, The Island of the Day Before, Baudolino, and now The Mysterious Flame of Queen Luana. These books are published by Harcourt. He's the author as well of many books of essays and scholarly works, the essays including Travels in Hyperreality, How to Travel with a Salmon, but works about semiology, about the Middle Ages. This new book is a book of memory, and in certain ways it corresponds to some of the things you say about the construction of wonder cabinets. It seems to have in common certain ideas with the idea of memory theater.
Certainly. The memory theater and the Wunderkammer, the German wonder cabinet. I conceived of the attic of this old mansion in the countryside really as one of those memory theaters that in the Renaissance and in Baroque era were conceived in order, we have probably to explain our listener, in order to allow people to remember things because they didn't have tape recorder or computers, they were obliged to imagine a sort of complex architecture with statues, images, in order to associate to each image or statue or passageway of that architectural ensemble a given concept or idea or something to remember. Well, my character, who is a person who has lost his memory and tries to retrieve his own identity, is trying to do so by revisiting all the memorabilia of his childhood. That's why the book is an illustrated novel, because even the images make part of this research. And, well, I was certainly thinking to those two great Baroque ideas, the theater of memory and the Wunderkammer, in which the collectors put everything that they could, from a stuffed crocodile to the horn of unicorn, and so on and so forth.
Now, the character then goes, his name is Yambo?
Yes.
Yes. He goes to his childhood home where the childhood nursemaid, the maid, is still there. He was her favorite. She doesn't necessarily want him to be opening these chambers. In fact, there's a secret chamber. Not only is there a secret chamber, but it seems to correspond in its way to an image of fog that he's had. There's a secret place as well that he will rediscover, the gorge. And so the house and the world seem to be shaped like his memories. But what this book has at its heart is something, it seems to me, to be truly seditious, that no matter how much he looks at his old comic books, his old dolls, nothing will really tell him who he is.
Yes. Maybe we have to, once again, to explain our listener that my character loses his memory, but only one part, the so-called autobiographical memory, the one by which you remember your name, you know that you are married with so and so and so. And then we have the so-called semantic memory. I would call it encyclopedical memory. the fact that one can remember that Tokyo is in Japan, or that, I don't know, Napoleon was a French emperor. He loses only the autobiographical memory and keeps the cultural memory, and which is scientifically possible. There are many clinical cases. And having lost the autobiographical memory, he has lost his identity. That's why the fog is so important in this book. It is a sort of red thread that goes through the entire novel. One reason is that I am born in the fog, in a foggy area. So there is a poetry of fog that always fascinated me. I mentioned fog many times in my other novels. Second, fog looked like a marvelous metaphor for the loss of memory. And, you mentioned also the secret room. The secret room can be another metaphor for this desperate effort to retrieve his own memory, because what happens to my character in the second part of the novel, in which he visits the attic of the mansion and defines all those things, is that he's still unable to recognize them, and so to reconstruct his own identity. On the contrary, he's reconstructing a sort of public identity, the identity of a generation. I have insisted very times in saying it's not an autobiographical book, it's the biography of a generation. Obviously, I gave my character a lot of personal memories, but really the fact that he is dealing with something objective in face of him, which doesn't belong. He's not a Proustian character. He doesn't excavate in his own soul to find again something, because he has no more soul. And so he's working with a sort of public soul and public memory. The secret room, if you want, is an homage paid to the children books he read, that were French stories full of young boys discovering the secret room in an old castle, the concealed treasury, and so on and so forth. So I wanted a secret room even in my countryside home.
He talks about all of his memories of paper, and there's the infinite sadness that, as a used book dealer, although he remembers so much of what he's read, this will not reconstitute him. And in some sense, there is the sense that even before he lost his memory, something had shut down and he had accepted a life that would not be at the beck and call of his secret passions.
Yes, that's yours is not a question, is a subtle reading and analysis of my novel. I cannot but agree even with that connection between the secret room the Yambo finds and the adventure in a gorge, like the adventure in another closed universe, in this case closed by fog. Because we have to explain that in the third part of the novel, my protagonist has a second stroke, he's in coma, and then he retrieves his memory and his identity, and even the reasons that explain why his life went in a given direction, including two main facts. One, a love of his 16 years, and a terrible adventure that of which he was the protagonist at the age of 13 during the Partisan War, another adventure that takes place within the fog, the deepest fog ever described in my novel, and probably many, many other novels. Yes, and I agree with your reading.
Well, the reason I give it is because I want to establish that this novel is in fact the opposite of what it appears to be. In the novel of this kind, say normally. There's a Bildungsroman. This is backwards. He's going backwards into his childhood. And he's going backwards not to find himself, but to find the point at which he lost himself.
Yeah.
So it's the opposite of Proust. And more than that, in a way, the opposite of Joyce, because, you see, it's almost a novel about the perils of getting lost in the encyclopedic memory.
I like very much what you are saying, because all my previous novels were clearly Bildungsroman, the story of a young man who grows up and learns something until his death. And you are right. If there is a word which is the contrary of Bildung, let's say it's Bildung, something like that. If Bildung is a step-by-step construction of his own self, well, this Bildung is the deconstruction, not in the common literary or philosophical sense, but the dismantling of a self. Yes, that's.
And you see, it seemed to me that if there is a criticism that you faced from the very beginning as a novel writer, it's the claim that you rely too much on an encyclopedic knowledge. And this book is there to say that, no, the encyclopedic knowledge, I too believe, is insufficient.
Absolutely right. And I think that the last images of the book with this sort of Ziegfeld Follies apocalypse, the real revelation he tries to have is the revelation of his real life as an adolescent, and not all the wisdom he received during his adult life, and which is the only heritage that he keeps after having lost the biographical memory.
And it's almost as if in the hands of the priests, as well as the secrecies of partisanship and the tragedies of the Second World War, he's shunted away from his true self, and it's replaced by the mountains of paper and their mental organization, so that in a sense, this poor young man doesn't have a chance.
Well, I cannot say that the book is so much optimistic. when joking, I'm saying that I'm very proud of my memory. I have a very good memory. But getting older and older, I am afraid to you know, when you are aging, one of the first risks is to lose your memory. I always used to say that to die of cancer is nothing, but to lose his own memory for an intellectual, for a professor. So maybe I wrote all that in order to have something to read when I have lost my memory, in order to remember who I was.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Umberto Eco, the author most recently of The Mysterious Flame of Queen Luana, published by Harcourt. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Umberto Eco. His new novel is The Mysterious Flame of Queen Luana. You have said at times that you feel the notes to The Wasteland are part of the poem.
Yes.
And I feel that the list of acknowledgments is a part of this book. And when we see so many times that this collage was made by the author, Umberto Eco, that this comic book cover is part of Umberto Eco's collection, that these translations are texts dear to the author Umberto Eco, we're both simultaneously asked to see a double voice and the place where they join, that there's a divergence point as well. That's what I think.
Listen, one of my ideas is that sometimes a book can be more intelligent than its own author. The list of the sources is due only to the American frenzy of having every piece of quotation exactly quoted. If not, you can be sued. And if I had to make only the Italian edition or the French edition, this list of sources would have not have. America, it is so mandatory, so we were obliged to make an exact list of all the quotations, and then it. But then, for you, the reader, it produces a sort of effect that it was not foreseen by the author, but which is present in the structure of the text. And so I would say you are right. You have the right to say so.
Well, yes and no, because I suspected that this was true of the American edition only, and yet still there is one picture in the book. It's the picture of Bing Crosby's The Road to Morocco, and strangely, it's a picture of the colorized cassette tape cover. And it's well out of Yambo's set of concerns, but I do feel that the book is talking to us about what time does, that time colorizes, that time alters, that time produces constantly new editions of the thing we held dear. That when he sees...
Which is the structure of memory.
Memory itself.
It is mentioned at the beginning by the doctor, we never remember something as it really happened, but every time we remember it, we add to it something more due to the new context in which we remember it, and so on and so forth, certainly. Certainly. So, yes, certainly on my part, it was the novel was my way to revisit all this material that existed before. But there are many things that happened to me in revisiting it in order to write the novel. For instance, I speak of a sort of schizophrenic education a child of that age received in the 30s, in the 40s, because on one side there was the fascist official rhetorical militaristic education. On the other side, there were the silly radio songs or the comic books, American movies, and probably it was this kind of schizophrenic education made of several contrasting inputs that helped us to realize what we were and what we had to become. But the point that I realized this kind of schizophrenia only when collecting the material for the book. Only at that point I discovered that this fascist song was of 39. This comic book was 39. This movie was 39. And suddenly I had the impression of what was my situation, because in the same year I received those three contrasting inputs. In this way, you see, it was not an act of remembering something that was already there, but in remembering to make new discovery and to add an additional meaning to the remembered items. That's true, yes.
Now, tell me, because in the last section of the novel, which is my favorite, he is, as you say, in a coma, very likely near death. Although he is aware of his wife and his children outside, probably waiting for him to come out of the coma, he knows that the line of activity of his brain is probably completely flat, that he is thinking beneath the surface of recordable thought. And in those thoughts, his entire family is absent. It seems to me that this novel is in some way about the life unlived and how the lived life replaces it. And as such, it seemed tremendously sad. Can you talk to me about that?
You know, once I have decided that the origins of many problems of my Yambo were depending of certain images and experiences of his childhood and at most of his early adolescence, I had to devote this comma section to the rediscovery of the real events of the childhood and of the early adolescence. While his marriage, the fact that he had daughter, belonged to his adult life. So I was in a way compelled, you know, that from the beginning his wife tells him, but even when you were okay, you were always pretty ambiguous about your childhood. You wouldn't speak about that. So it is clear that he had a sort of blockage. He was unable to go back to his childhood. He wanted to forget it. So it was important for me in the third part to make him to retrieve exactly those elements. I didn't think that was extremely sad, but I agree with you, because since his real secret lied in that in those years, it seems that the whole of his adult life has been irrelevant. It has been dominated and disturbed by those early facts, and so it's a tragedy, yes, because it has become irrelevant, yes.
But she seems, the wife, she's a psychiatrist, she seems to love him very much, or at least to care for him willingly, and yet the further back he goes, he discovers a truth that renders her love irrelevant, and because of his memory loss, he can't remember how they met, why they loved, has his affair with a woman in his bookshop been more important to him than his marriage? And as he goes further and further back, as a kind of dream waltz surrounds him, of characters and places and books and songs and cartoons and movies, but people as well, people from his village, his relatives. It seems as if what he is finding out at the moments before his death is that he has not lived at the center of his most precious possibility.
Yes, seeing under this profile, it is the story of a failure, certainly. But it is also the story centered about the lost image of the early love. And the book ends while he's unable to grasp the real image of the girl he loved. So in this sense is the history of the poetry of the childhood and adolescence. That's why the adult life is so irrelevant. It didn't interest me. And I don't know if I am entitled to make private biographical remarks that I have nothing to do with the book, but maybe yes. The story of the girl he loved at the age of 16 is obviously true, but I think belongs to the memory of each of us. Every human person had about that age, a sort of platonic love of this kind. And personally, since I had lost this girl after the high school, all the rest of my life, I have always thought, but one day or another, I want to find again this girl. And to tell you, didn't know, but I was in love with you and so on and so forth. And since she lived in my native city, I sometimes received news by my friends that she's sick, she has become enormously fat, she cannot walk any longer, she's old. I always said to myself, but one day or another, I want to go there. And 1 year before, or maybe less, before starting writing that novel, somebody told me that she died. And so I had lost the possibility of seeing her again and tell her. That was probably the main reason by which I started telling this story. And this explains why the story is centered about this age. And in order to make that short period from the mid of the 30s to the mid of the 40s or a little more, so relevant, I was obliged to discard all the rest. So I was, as a narrator, I was not interested in saying something about his adult life. But you are right in saying that in focusing so much that period and leaving all the rest to fall down, I have, in a way, ruined the adult life of my character. I had to sacrifice his adult life in order to make the little poem of his adolescence.
I just understood that instead of memories of things past, this is memories of things lost.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
I've been speaking with Umberto Eco, author most recently of The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana, published by Harcourt. Thank you, Dr. Eco, for joining me.
Thank you.
I've very much enjoyed it.
Thanks.
You can read an excerpt from The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Linda Todoroff. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.